Hello, thank you so much for being willing to talk to me about some of the ways that partition is talked about and understood in India.
Thank you, Professor Jessica Kane, all the way from Albion College in Michigan. And I'm Professor Pankaj Jain at Plain University in India. And today we are discussing Professor Kane's topics of partition and
Dear. There we go. I think the internet connection might be a little bit iffy, so occasionally we might need to repeat things,
sure.
but that's all right. So my students in one of my upper level English classes have been reading literature from the former British Empire. So the class is 20th century British literature, and I wanted them to read literature that wasn't just centered on England. And so one of the places that we've been reading literature from is India and Pakistan, particularly focused around partition. And so we read Anita Dese's Clear Light of Day and Bapsi Sidwa's Cracking India. And we are also in the middle, actually, of watching the film Garam Hawa, which the students have actually gotten really into, which has been very fun.
Okay. Which film is that? Sorry, how do you spell it?
What's that?
The film name again? Which film?
Garam Hawa.
Okay, we have. Is it a Hindi film?
I think so.
Okay, not yet. The recent film? Garam Hawa. Sorry.
Don't
Oh, wait. Oh, yes.
know. We're falling prey to my poor pronunciation here.
That's a classic. Yes. Of course.
Yes, and that's been good. And I was excited because it's just very different cinematic norms from contemporary American films, and
Yeah,
so
for sure.
I'm happy that they've really gotten into it and are sort of really emotionally engaged with it. So that's been a lot of fun.
Right. So I have actually prepared a list of several films that I have seen that are based on partition. Probably I shared with you also when I was there at Albion
Yes.
last summer. And those films, some of such films are Garam Hawa, you already mentioned, which means hot wind or hot air. Then there is a film called Khuda Ke Liye that was made in Pakistan. Then there is a film called Train to Pakistan that's based on Khushwant Singh's novel of the same title, Train to Pakistan. Then there is 1947 Urge, which has the famous star Amir Khan, that's based on those themes. Then there is Chhaliya, which stars Raj Kapoor and Nutan and Rehman and so on. That's in 1960s or so. It's a black and white film. Then there is Dharmputra that was made by B.R. Chopra. That's from 50s, also early, really early film. Then Dhool Ka Phool, then Mammo, then Nastik, then Pinjar, which is a recent, relatively recent film. Then there are two TV, long before web series, we had TV serials in India and also US. And two of those series deal with these themes of partition and so on, Tamas and Bunyad. And both were made by same team, same director, same writer, and so on. Ramesh Sippy and Manoj Joshi. Then there is another Pakistani film called Khamosh Pani, which is Silent Water. So these are some of the key films that deal with these themes. Yeah.
That's very exciting that I can share some of these film titles with my students. And so if they can hopefully begin, now that they have some kind of context for the films, that they would go and be able to watch some themselves and be able to understand them a little bit more.
Right, sure.
So
Big help, big help.
learning about some of these periods in history, the literature of these periods in history, the students had a lot of questions about it, particularly because they were doing a lot of, I think, what is commonly done, which is comparing these moments in history to some things that they think about in terms of US history and their own connection to it, and wondering how these historical events are present or not present in modern day India and for modern day Indians. And so the students and I came up with a couple of questions to ask you.
Sure.
The first one is whether or not you feel any kind of connection to partition.
Yes, I thought about that question. Those of us who were born in the 1970s, 80s, really have really, really distant, faint memories as if something happened to our grandparents. Those who were not born in the border states of Punjab or Bengal, I think those were the two states that were most affected. Very, very deeply wounded in many ways. But I was born in Rajasthan, and my state does have a border that touches Pakistan. But because of the desert, this is the largest desert in the world we're talking about, Thar Desert. So that area of border is relatively extremely thinly populated, even though it does have the richest flora and fauna in the world. But human population is very thin along the borders. So I don't recall anything that my parents or grandparents ever talked about partition. My mom used to talk about the wars that happened in 60s and 70s, much later on after the partition. But partition itself remains, I think it really comes to us only through films. So some of the films that are still, you know, they go back to these themes. Not all the films, but very rarely some film comes across again. And that's how we are reminded of partition. Otherwise, it's not really part of our daily discourse, especially those of us who are not in Bengal.
Sure. Why do you think that it is such a topic for films, given that it doesn't really feel very, very relevant to most people who are living now, their daily life?
Yeah, it's not that relevant also even for the film, but there are these films that I also made a list. And I think filmmakers are always looking to make money, of course. And they spend millions and millions of dollars, probably, you know, touching even billions, probably in Hollywood. But in Indian terms, that heavy investments must be recovered at all costs from the film producer's point of view, right? So they're always looking for a story that can connect with people. And I think they do this to show some of the relevant issues that are happening even in today's India, not related to partition, but definitely related to religious conflicts or even caste-based conflicts. And conflicts are present across the world. And it seems that Indian films tend to still be grounded on the social realities rather than sci-fi or, you know, totally out-of-the-world films, such as probably in Hollywood, the superhero films that are really talking about sci-fi and so on. Sci-fi has not yet caught it, not yet caught that much attention in Indian films. So that may be one reason that maybe out of 100 films, you know, 5 films can go back to partition and Hindu-Muslim issue. 5%. Sure. Right? I've not done any, you know, statistical research, but out of my assessment of and watching every single film over the last 6-7 decades, especially the classics, there are some films that keep going back to those themes. And probably that's, again, they are trying to find out another innovative theme that can probably be different from run-of-the-mill films, such as Garam Hawa. Garam Hawa is not, like you mentioned, the first thing that you mentioned, Garam Hawa, hot wind, hot air. It stars Balraj Sahni. Now, Balraj Sahni was never a star, not a popular star in India. People who watch Balraj Sahni films are much less compared to those who go and watch films of Dilip Kumar or Raj Kapoor or Rajendra Kumar, Rajesh Khanna, and so on. Those are the popular stars. Balraj Sahni films are really thought-provoking, very serious, dense, intense film. And it's the film is really talking to really intellectual elites of the society. That's where Garam Hawa sits. And then there is one more, actually. Garam Hawa and Garam Coat, hot coat, warm coat. So those are the titles with Garam, which means hot or warm.
Yeah.
Right? And and then Balraj Sahni's brother is Bhishma Sahni. And Bhishma Sahni, probably now passed away, both of them passed away now. But Bhishma Sahni wrote this novel called Tamas. Tamas means darkness. And darkness, that novel led to a TV series called Tamas, which means darkness, same title. That was also extremely controversial when it came to Indian television channel. We had only one channel that time, Doordarshan, which was the girlfriend channel. And it raised some controversies that it showed some violence, really graphic violence around partition. That was, I'm talking 1980s again. So these are the TV series, these were the TV series and films that were really consumed by the intellectual elites, not by popular masses.
I see. We noticed when we were watching it, we were commenting on Garam Hawa's use of architecture as a frame, that many of the scenes, the people are situated in various ways, in windows, behind blinds, within columns and arches and things like that. And then also the use of reflection that all seem to reflect this sort of more artistic eye that you're speaking of a kind of film. Very interesting. And then what about, so when we think about when Americans are taught about US history, that's usually in fourth or fifth grade. So when they're 8 to 10 years old, at what age are Indian children or Indian children taught about Indian history, particularly history like partition? And if so, at what age are they taught about this?
No, okay, so I can speak for myself. I went to a small school in Rajasthan for the private school. Most Indian families send their kids, they prefer to send their kids to private schools for, you know, higher standard of education. So, but the board that we follow is government board. So I was in Rajasthan board school. Rajasthan, as I said, is on the border of India and Pakistan. So the history that we were taught was standard, you know, three major empires, Mauryan Empire, Gupta Empire, and Mughal Empire, and then the British Raj, and modern India. So partition is like a footnote in this entire narrative of Indian history. It's so large, such a lengthy history. We're talking at least 3,000 years of history. If we include Indus Valley Civilization, we're talking 5,000-6,000 years of history. Sure. So it's very difficult for a textbook writer or a teacher to cover 6,000 years of history for a middle school or even for high school. So we started Indus Valley, then Mauryan Indus Valley, then Buddha and Mahavir, Buddhism, Jainism history, then Mauryan Empire, Gupta Empire, Mughal Empire, and British Raj in modern India. We do great injustice, even with this standard narrative of history, we do great injustice to, let's say, to Southern Indian history. Southern India had its own empires that never catch the attention of people in Northern India, even Northern Indian schools and teachers. So those empires are all, for example, Chola Empire is rarely discussed in North Indian school textbooks. So partition is like a, you know, small blip in the long history. Some two of the longest surviving civilizations on the planet today are China and India. Both have 5,000-6,000 years of continuous history. So partition comes and goes, you know, some political boundaries keep changing. What does not change is the consciousness, the civilizational consciousness that makes these huge civilizations continue to survive, even though some portions of the ancient Indian civilization is now part of Pakistan or even Afghanistan or Bangladesh or Nepal or Myanmar or even Sri Lanka. But when Indians are, let's say Hindus are doing some prayers, they would still include the river Indus, which is, the name is Sindhu, which becomes Indus. So the river actually is in Pakistan, but that river gave our country the name India. Indus, India. Indus' original name is Sindhu. Sindhu gave the word Hindu, which is the name of the religion, the largest majority religion in India. So Sindhu, Hindu. So name itself derives from a river, name of the religion derives from a river in Pakistan, name of the country derives from a river which is in Pakistan. Yet the partition itself is not really in the back of our minds. You know what? So we think that our civilization, our culture is so vast that political boundaries don't really matter. Of course it matters. You know, if anything happens on the border, it will be immediately countered, it will be immediately stopped. And, you know, maybe a stronger, even stronger response today will be given by the, you know, more nationalistic kind of government that we have. But in the common people's mind, they are praying, they're including Sindhu, that is Indus River, in their prayers. Sindhu, Indus River is in India's national anthem. Punjab, Sindhu, Gujarat, Maratha, there is one of the lines in the national anthem, it includes the river that is in Pakistan now. So if the civilization consciousness remains intact, so Bangladesh, for example, has one of the most ancient goddess temples called Dhakeshwari. Dhaka is the capital of Bangladesh. Dhaka name comes from Dhakeshwari, which is a Hindu goddess. So Bangladesh probably today is the third largest Muslim country in the world after Indonesia and Pakistan and India and then probably Bangladesh, fourth largest. But the name of the capital comes from a Hindu goddess, Dhakeshwari. And just recently, last week, a couple of days back actually, Indian Prime Minister was in Indonesia. And Indonesia, there is an island called Bali. And Indonesia as a whole, as a country, is the largest Muslim country in the world. But it has, even it has kept its Hindu consciousness alive for millennia. It has Hindu gods and goddesses publicly displayed. Even until recently, its Indonesian currency had Hindu gods and goddesses. It still has performance traditions that are based on the story of Hindu god, Hindu hero, Ramayana hero, Lord Rama. So Ramayana stories are being performed by Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, and on across Asia, even Russia and Iran and China, Japan, across Asia, Ramayana story, the oldest Hindu epic Ramayana, is a living tradition across Asia, not just in India. So this, this is a civilizational consciousness. And today we can expand this consciousness even to include yoga and Ayurveda and meditation and even Bollywood. That is now a global phenomenon. These are all global phenomena. So that is, and Indian diaspora itself is the largest diaspora in the world in terms of number of people and in terms of foreign remittance that comes to India from this diaspora to their motherland. So all these things make our perspective even wider on temporal scale and on spatial scale, right? Chronologically and by space. It is such a vast, infinite, it never started, it will never end. That's the idea of infinity, that when we talk about Indian consciousness, Indian civilizational consciousness, it never started and it will never end. Nobody started it. No one founded to the religion. No one founded to the country. No one book that started the country or the civilization. It's an ever-expanding universe that just keeps on expanding and parting all from this last time scale.
Right. That's such an interesting view of the country's both history past, present, and future, and is so compared to what the way I think the United States really glorifies the founders in many ways, that to have this much more expansive both temporal and spatial view of India is so interesting. Besides this very expansive view, so like recognizing that India and Indian civilization is so much bigger, it's millennia long, and we don't know where it started, and it's enormous, like in terms of geography. Are there other things that you wish Americans or Westerners knew about India? Because I think like it's the Westerners are often not taught very much about the world in general, and particularly outside of Europe are really not taught very much about that at all. What would you wish that people, that Americans would know about India?
Some of these things that I already mentioned, what makes these two civilizations survive and even thrive for millennia, China and India, not just India, but China also, which should include. But I guess India has more tightly embraced its traditions, even more than China. I think China officially is not a communist country, so on. But India sticks to its roots for millennia. So I was recently in Varanasi, one of the oldest cities in the world. Varanasi, also called it Banaras or Kashi. And what I see is, what I saw, what I experienced there is, you know, being in the US for more than two decades, and now that I'm back in India, and when I go to these cities, it is like almost like a reverse culture shock. And what I see is that in the evening, one of the local professors, local senior scholar, he comes to me and he tells Pankaj, tomorrow morning, 5:30, you have to go to Ganga. Ganga is the name of the holiest river in India, Ganga or Ganges. And you experience what there happens and you let me know how you feel. I said, I thought if I wake up, I'll go, I'll see. So, but what I see next morning is at 5 a.m., there are fireworks noises across the city. Why? Because today is the day, I'm talking 2 weeks back, today, that day was the day when an annual festival to revere the sun. What happens on that day is mothers would fast for at least 24 hours without food, without water, of course, fasting. And they would break their fast only by having a darshan, that is a visual communion, a sight of the sun god. So 5:30 a.m., they would all gather at the banks of the river Ganga, Ganges, to have the first darshan of the sun god. And as soon as they see the sun god, they would offer their newly cropped, new harvest of their crops. So they offer their first crop to the sun god, and then they break their fast by taking the first dip of the holy water from holy river Ganga. So the point that I want to make is that for thousands of years, Indians across the Indian civilization have kept their consciousness keep their consciousness in sync with nature by revering the sun god by revering goddess Ganga, goddess Earth, and Mother Nature in general. So general Mother Nature in general includes, of course, planet Earth, Mother Goddess Earth. Literally, when they wake up, there's a Sanskrit saying that, Mother, please forgive me. You are my mother, but I'm touching you with my feet as I wake up in the morning. So that consciousness to be in sync with nature, that is something I think really would benefit Americans, not just American students, but worldwide. I think if we can be really, now we're talking about climate change and so on, to be in sync with climate, to be in sync with nature. But these are the elements of Indian consciousness that every year, almost every week, there are some festivals, festivities, some holy days, sacred days in Hinduism, Jainism, Buddhism, even indigenous, the tradition that came from outside, but they got indigenized and they got Indianized. And lastly, that across the religions in India, there is this large consciousness that we cannot ignore nature, we cannot ignore rivers, we have to take care of people, we have to revere river, we have to revere the sun and the Mother Earth. And so, I think this is one of the most important reasons, I think, in my opinion, that has kept Indian people survive for thousands of years. Population keeps booming in India, which is not a good thing. Population should be controlled, but why population thrives even with so little resources? That we need to think that, you know, India survives, Professor Kane, India survives with more than four times, definitely more than three times more population than America, right, but less than three times resources than America, right? Water is very limited. Earth, land itself is very limited. And on food, everything is limited. But there are very rare, if any, we hear any conflict that people are fighting for water. Of course, there are tensions and so on. But largely, 1.4 billion people today are surviving, largely because of their needs are still limited. Even though they can afford to buy four cars, maybe, but they will keep their luxuries, even today, they will keep it limited. The three generations of family, every family, almost every family in India, even today, three generations live under a single roof. Can you imagine, Professor Kane, in US, where, you know, even one generation, if they can live together, that would be an accomplishment for life. Here, three generations. In my own example, I work and teach in Pune, but every weekend, I will go to Thane, Mumbai, and spend my weekend, every weekend, 3 days with my parents. So this bonding within family, across generations, three generations, as I said, bonding with nature, these are the things I think that really can be an important lesson for students and general public worldwide.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the time that you took to talk to us a little bit about both Indian history and then some of contemporary India as well. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.